Welcome to the audio digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for the month of November 2008. Please note that the full text of all articles may be viewed online at ajp.psychiatryonline.org, including all author affiliations and disclosures. This month, our clinical case conference will highlight the role of culture in psychodynamic psychotherapy. Our research articles will include two clinical trials of antipsychotic medications for children and adolescents. In one study, a first-generation antipsychotic and two second-generation drugs were compared. In the other study, two doses of aripiprazole were compared with placebo. An editorial about these trials will discuss their important features. We'll also feature a clinical trial of naltrexone in the treatment of amphetamine dependence. From there, we'll turn to a diagnostic study that identified differences and similarities between depression following bereavement and depression associated with other stressful life events. We'll conclude with an analysis indicating that cognitive function in older adults is influenced by the interaction between cortisol and the genotype for apolipoprotein E. An editorial that examines the implications of this research will also be highlighted. Let's begin with the clinical case conference. Carolyn Rodriguez and colleagues present a case that illustrates the role of culture in psychodynamic psychotherapy. Parallel process resulting from cultural similarities between patient and therapist. The patient was a 38-year-old Ecuadorian woman in her first year of medical school. She stated her chief complaint as, "I wish I could just accept and love my boyfriend." The resident who treated the patient provides the first perspective. The resident was also Hispanic, and their common ethnicity and professional interest led to an initial perception of sameness. However, distance was maintained in psychotherapy by speaking in English and not focusing on the patient's Hispanic heritage. The patient's self-esteem seemed tenuous initially, and the resident used mostly supportive interventions. Yet even when the patient seemed more comfortable expressing her emotions, there were ways in which the therapy had not moved forward. The resident realized that her presumption of sameness had resulted in neglect of the patient's individuality. After reviewing a videotape of a therapy session, the resident's supervisor remarked that the patient seemed younger than her stated age and that she was speaking like a little girl. The resident realized that she was enacting a mothering role rather than interpreting the patient's need for mothering. The patient had needed support to learn how to care for herself and to titrate her closeness to the resident. Now that the patient was healthier, the resident needed to inch toward closeness with her. She asked the patient to describe ways in which women took on a mothering role in her family. It became apparent that the patient's relationship with her mother was at the center of her fears about attachment and dependency. The patient's version of her family history was the history not of their psychiatric problems, but the romantic tragedies of broken women. It sounded almost like a folktale. The patient perceived that all women in her family were destined to have ill-fated relationships. By understanding this, the patient was able to link her fear of intimacy with her boyfriend to the assumption that she would be broken and depressed if she allowed herself to fall in love and marry. As parallels were drawn between the real-life situations in her childhood and her current conflicts, the patient began dressing more like an adult woman. There was a similar transformation in her transference to the resident, and she acknowledged her fear that if she became an adult, nobody would look out for her. The supervisor provides additional insights. Noting that both the patient and resident had Hispanic names, she asked the resident about her own background. During the conversation, the supervisor noticed that she herself was being careful about her pronunciation of Spanish words and had become self-conscious about her own non-Hispanic background. She realized that she was engaged in a parallel process. a situation in which the therapist unconsciously identifies with something that has been stirred up in the patient and then enacts it in the supervisory relationship. This realization enabled the supervisor to focus on the patient rather than the resident's personal issues. The supervisor pointed out the resident's presumption of sameness with the patient. Abandoning this view allowed the resident to ask the patient more about her unique background. Second, it allowed the resident to realize that her fear of merging with the patient had led to her initial avoidance of cultural issues. Finally, it allowed the resident to realize that the patient needed more than just encouragement to overcome her inhibitions. The Grand Rounds discussant observes that although similarities in background and language may result in better services, there are also pitfalls. Some of these relate to the language of training for the therapist. The therapist may feel less authoritative or articulate in his or her native language. In addition, psychiatrists in training learn to listen for both content and process. Process listening is used to identify evasions, defenses, or associations. It's likely based on language and may not be easily accessible without training in the language in which the therapy is conducted. Difficulties may also arise if the therapist assumes that he or she knows what the patient means and expends less effort in exploratory work. The therapist may also assume that the patient will be more open about culture-specific ideas. Knowing the patient's language can also be useful. Individuals may have access to different memories in different languages. Using the native language could even facilitate psychodynamic therapies, which are designed to allow patients to explore fantasies and primitive wishes. Now we'll turn to the clinical trials. First is the report by Lynn Marie Sickage and colleagues on a double-blind comparison of first- and second-generation antipsychotics in early-onset schizophrenia and schizoaffective disorder. The study participants were more than 100 youth with schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, or schizophreniform disorder. They were between the ages of 8 and 19 and had varied histories, including both first episode and chronic illness. They were randomly assigned to three drugs, which were administered in a double-blind fashion for 8 weeks. The first-generation antipsychotic was Molindone, and the second-generation drugs were olanzapine and risperidone. Dosing was flexible within a specified range. The medications were initiated at the lowest dose in the range, and over 2 weeks the doses were increased to the middle of the range. The range for Molindone was 10 to 140 milligrams per day. For olanzapine, the range was 2.5 to 20 milligrams per day. And for risperidone, it was 0.5 to 6 milligrams a day. All of the participants treated with Molindone also received 1 milligram a day of benztropine. All others received a placebo that looked identical. The primary outcome was responder status at the end of the trial. Response was defined by three criteria. The first was a clinical global impression improvement score of 1 or 2, indicating much or very much improved. The second criterion was a 20% reduction in the score on the positive and negative syndrome scale. The third was the ability to tolerate 8 weeks of treatment. Individuals who withdrew before 8 weeks were considered non-responders. Random assignment to olanzapine was discontinued by the NIMH Data and Safety Monitoring Board. Interim data showed a greater increase in weight with olanzapine than the other two drugs, without evidence of greater efficacy. Participants being treated with olanzapine at the time of the decision continued their participation. The rates of response were 50% for Molindone, 46% for risperidone, and 34% for olanzapine. This difference was not statistically significant. All groups had significant declines from baseline in the total PANSS score, positive and negative symptom subscale scores, total score on the child version of the BPRS, and total score on the child and adolescent functional assessment scale, but there were no significant differences among groups. Adverse effects led to premature treatment discontinuation in 8 patients taking Molindone, 6 patients taking olanzapine, and 5 taking risperidone. Frequent adverse events included sedation, irritability, and anxiety. Participants in the Molendone group reported significantly more drug-induced akathisia. Those in the olanzapine group had significantly higher rates of weight gain and increased appetite. Changes in weight and body mass index differed significantly among the three groups. Youth treated with olanzapine gained an average of 6.1 kilograms. Those treated with risperidone gained 60% as much weight, whereas those receiving Molendone showed no changes in body mass. The olanzapine group also showed greater increases in several metabolic measures and in rate-corrected QT intervals. In the Molendone group, the scores for akathisia increased significantly, with 18% of the patients developing moderate or severe akathisia. The risperidone group had marked increases in prolactin levels, which did not occur in the other two groups. Now we'll highlight the report by Robert Findling and colleagues on a multiple-center, randomized, double-blind, placebo-controlled study of oral aripiprazole for treatment of adolescents with schizophrenia. Aripiprazole is a dopamine partial agonist that has been shown to be efficacious for adults. It's important to determine its side effects for adolescents because youths may be more vulnerable to extrapyramidal symptoms and weight gain from antipsychotics. The participants in this trial were 13 to 17 years old and had a diagnosis of schizophrenia. More than 300 were randomly assigned to three treatment groups: placebo, 10 milligrams a day of aripiprazole, and 30 milligrams a day of aripiprazole. The target doses were phased in and were maintained for at least 2 weeks. Subjects who experienced unacceptable tolerability problems before day 25 were removed from the study. After day 25, a dose reduction was permitted. The trial lasted for 6 weeks. The primary efficacy assessment was the mean change in the total score on the positive and negative syndrome scale. This was determined by comparing the values at baseline and the last observed visit. Assessments were also performed at weekly visits throughout the study. The 6-week trial was completed by 85% of the enrolled subjects. The dropout rate did not differ among the three treatment groups. Of the 44 non-completers, 13 withdrew because of adverse events. Both doses of aripiprazole were more efficacious than placebo, as demonstrated by significantly greater improvements on the PANSS total score. Both active treatment groups also had more improvement in scores on the subscale for positive symptoms. The group receiving 10 milligrams of aripiprazole also showed significantly greater decreases in negative symptoms at 6 weeks. Also, at the end of 6 weeks, improvement in scores on the Children's Global Assessment Scale was greater for both aripiprazole groups than for the placebo group. The most common adverse events associated with aripiprazole were extrapyramidal disorder, somnolence, and tremor. The incidence of these adverse events appeared to be consistently higher at the 30 milligram dose than at the 10 milligram dose. The rates of serious treatment-emergent adverse events were low for all groups, with an incidence of 3% in the placebo group, 4% in the group taking 10 milligrams of aripiprazole, and 4% in those taking 30 milligrams. Neither group receiving active treatment had a substantial weight gain, but the change differed among groups because of weight loss in the placebo group. The reduction in serum prolactin was greater for aripiprazole than for placebo. In an editorial, Randall Ross points out important features of the Sickage and Findling studies. One of these is the length of the trials. Practical and ethical concerns often limit antipsychotic trials to 6 or 8 weeks. For antipsychotic use in children and adolescents, there's some suggestion that early response correlates with long-term outcome. Conversely, it's also been argued that there's an early nonspecific response that peaks around 6 weeks, followed by a reduction in benefit. What may appear to be small, non-significant differences between treatment arms at 6 to 8 weeks will gradually increase and become clinically relevant over time. Direct comparison of medications using flexible decision points and longer durations will be critical before fully informed judgments are available. However, some conclusions can still be drawn from these two studies. For children, there is an average delay of at least 2 years between the onset of psychosis and the initial diagnosis. Sometimes this delay is due to symptom identification, clinical workup, and progression through the healthcare system to reach a qualified specialist. In other cases, presentation for care is associated with more severe symptoms, hospitalization, or expulsion from school or other type of resource depletion. Findling and colleagues report that the responses to both doses of aripiprazole were similar, although the higher dose was associated with both faster response and more adverse effects. For stable children and adolescent patients, this study supports the dosing philosophy of start low and go slow. However, for more acutely ill or resource-depleted patients, the additional risk of adverse events from a higher dosing may be countered by the potential advantages of more rapid response. Closer examination of the Sikich and Findling reports shows less clinical benefit than is indicated by statistically positive results. There were a total of 6 treatment arms: placebo, molindone, olanzapine, risperidone, and the 2 aripiprazole groups. All of them, including placebo, demonstrated a 12-16% decrease in symptoms over the first 2 weeks of treatment. By 6 weeks, the placebo arm had a symptom decrease of 22%, while the active treatment arms had decreases of 23-30%. Thus, the effect size of antipsychotic medications in child and adolescent patients is relatively low. Although non-response might be expected in chronically ill patients, these relatively poor responses occurred early in the illness. Adolescents are more likely to be in their first episode and thus possibly more responsive to intervention. However, a younger age at the onset of schizophrenia often means a more severe disease course with poorer response to treatment. The relative contributions of these two conflicting possibilities are difficult to disentangle. The response rate in these two studies is similar to the 50% response rate observed for olanzapine and risperidone in adult populations. However, in adults, non-response to one antipsychotic does not necessarily predict non-response to a different one. Since there are few short-term differences in outcome with the various antipsychotics, the side effect profile should guide the clinician's choice of which agent to prescribe first. Olanzapine may not be an optimal first-line choice, but this recommendation may change as longer-term studies become available. Initial doses should be low for children and adolescents with low short-term risks for suicide or violence, particularly if they're in supportive and stable home environments. However, the acute risk is higher for some, either because of their own behavior or because of the impact on their social support. For these children and adolescents, higher initial doses are often a better choice. After 6 to 8 weeks, an alternative antipsychotic can be considered. As in adults, treatment failure after 2 to 3 antipsychotic trials warrants consideration of clozapine. In addition, outcomes for children and adolescents are closely tied to the stability and mental health of their parents and extended support system. Treatments should include an evaluation of the support system. There are psychological, physiological, and metabolic issues unique to children and adolescents. Disconcerting side effects, such as akathisia or other extrapyramidal symptoms, may bias children against long-term use of effective medications. Risk of weight gain may be greater in younger patients, and early weight gain has strong lifelong negative metabolic implications. The effects of elevated prolactin levels in prepubertal children are unknown but worrisome, particularly in boys. Further trials specifically focused on children and adolescents are critical. Longer-term follow-up studies are required before formalized treatment strategies or policy decisions should be inferred. Now we'll turn to substance use disorders. Nitya Jayaram Lindstrom and colleagues tested naltrexone for the treatment of amphetamine dependence in a randomized placebo-controlled trial. The authors explain the rationale for trying naltrexone. Although the reinforcing effects of amphetamine are principally mediated via stimulation of the corticomesolimbic dopamine system, other neurotransmitter systems modulate dopamine in the brain. These include the mu opioid receptors located on the mesolimbic dopamine neurons. Furthermore, certain brain regions known to have a role in appetitive behaviors, such as the ventral tegmental area and substantia nigra, contain neurons in which dopamine and opioids coexist. The functional interaction of the dopamine-opioid system, specifically in stimulant abuse, is evident in preclinical and clinical studies. In this study, 80 patients with amphetamine dependence were randomly assigned to naltrexone or placebo for 12 weeks. They also received weekly relapse prevention treatment conducted in individual sessions with a psychologist. The patients in the experimental group received 50 milligrams of naltrexone per day. Urine samples were collected to test for the presence of amphetamine. They were also used to measure metabolite concentrations in the naltrexone group to determine treatment compliance. Among all the patients who began treatment, the proportion of urine samples that were negative for amphetamine was 65% for the naltrexone group and 48% for the placebo group. The mean number of negative tests before a relapse occurred was 13 for naltrexone and 6 for placebo. The patterns of results were similar in the patients who completed the study. The urinary metabolite concentration showed that more than half of the patients in the naltrexone group followed the treatment. Compliance was defined as the presence of the metabolite in more than 8 of the 12 weekly tests. There was a correlation between naltrexone compliance and reduction in drug use. The rates of compliance with the relapse prevention sessions were similar in the two groups. Subjective reports also demonstrated a difference between naltrexone and placebo. Ratings on a visual analog scale indicated a greater decrease in craving among the patients receiving naltrexone. The most common side effects of naltrexone were nausea, headache, fatigue, and gastrointestinal discomfort. 14 patients in the naltrexone group reported these side effects and rated them as mild. No patients discontinued the study because of adverse effects. We'll turn now to a question posed by Kenneth Kendler and colleagues. Does bereavement-related major depression differ from major depression associated with other stressful life events? DSM-IV assigns a special status to bereavement. A depressive episode that's associated with bereavement and has clinical features characteristic of normal grief is not diagnosed as major depression. The validity of this distinction was examined in a large population-based sample of twins. They were interviewed 4 times over 10 years. At each interview, they were asked about stressful life events in the preceding year. Structured psychiatric interviews were also given. Major depression was diagnosed according to DSM-IV, but without the exclusion for bereavement. Bereavement-related depression was defined as the co-occurrence in the same month of both the onset of major depression and the report of a death of a family member or friend. In addition, the respondent confirmed that the depression was due to that death. From more than 9,000 individuals, 82 were identified as having bereavement-related depression. They were then compared with more than 200 respondents who had depression that was linked to stressful events in 3 other categories: divorce or separation, illness, and job loss. Bereavement-related depression and depression related to other stressful events were similar in many important ways. These include the duration of the index episode, frequency of severe impairment, number of prior episodes, age at onset, pattern of comorbidity, risk for future depressive episodes, and risk of major depression in the co-twin. Clinical severity was also similar, as reflected in the number of symptoms from DSM-IV Criterion A. Of interest, the DSM-IV symptomatic and duration criteria for normal grief were met by equal proportions of individuals in the two groups. The two types of depression did differ on 7 potential validators. Subjects with bereavement-related depression were slightly older, were more likely to be female, were more likely to report loss of interest and tiredness, were less likely to have sought treatment for the index episode, were less likely to report feelings of guilt, and had lower levels of neuroticism. The authors point out that given the number of tests performed, several of these results are likely to result from chance alone. DSM states that the diagnosis of major depressive disorder is generally not given unless the symptoms are still present 2 months after the loss. It also lists 6 features that are not characteristic of a normal grief reaction. On this basis, the authors created an operational definition of normal grief as a duration of no more than 2 months, plus the absence of psychomotor retardation, suicidal ideation, and severe work impairment. The percentages of subjects in the two groups who met these criteria were low and were similar, 28% of those with bereavement-related depression and 25% of those with depression related to other stressful events. Now we'll conclude with the gene-environment interaction examined by Brian Lee and colleagues. Apolipoprotein E genotype, cortisol, and cognitive function in community-dwelling older adults. The risk of Alzheimer's disease is increased by the epsilon-4 allele of the gene for apolipoprotein E, but the effects of the allele on cognitive performance in non-demented adults have not been established. However, it's also been found to amplify the effects of other risk factors for cognitive dysfunction. Psychosocial stress has been linked to cognitive aging. By using cortisol as a measure of stress, Lee and colleagues were able to examine whether the epsilon-4 allele is a mediating factor in the relationship between stress and cognitive decline. The study subjects were participants in the Baltimore Memory Study and were between the ages of 50 and 70. They completed 3 visits, an average of 14 months apart. Cognitive performance was tested at all 3 visits, but cortisol was measured at only 1 visit, either the 2nd or 3rd one. 4 saliva samples were collected before, during, and after the cognitive tests, and at the end of the visit. Data were available for more than 900 participants. The cognitive tests covered 7 domains: language, processing speed, eye-hand coordination, executive functioning, verbal memory and learning, visual memory, and visual construction. Domain scores were created by averaging the Z-scores for the individual tests within the domains. 3 cortisol metrics were created: the pretest value, the mean for all 4 samples, and the area under the curve with respect to 0. These metrics were hypothesized to represent different aspects of HPA axis activity. The area under the curve represents total hormonal output over a period of time. It was dichotomized at the 75th percentile to indicate the presence or absence of a high cortisol level. Approximately 30% of the participants had 1 or more epsilon-4 alleles of the gene for apolipoprotein E, or ApoE. The presence of 1 allele was not associated with lower cognitive domain scores, but the presence of 2 alleles was associated with worse performance in 3 cognitive domains. In addition, interactions between genotype and each of the 3 cortisol metrics were found in the domains of language, eye-hand coordination, verbal memory and learning, and visual construction. The interactions were most evident for participants with 2 epsilon-4 alleles. The authors also compared groups having each combination of cortisol level and genotype. The reference group contained the individuals who had no epsilon-4 alleles and were below the 75th percentile in regard to the cortisol area under the curve. Those with 1 or 2 epsilon-4 alleles but cortisol under the 75th percentile did not perform significantly different from the reference group in any domain. However, persons with 1 allele plus cortisol above the 75th percentile performed significantly worse in language, processing speed, eye-hand coordination, and executive functioning. Those with a high cortisol and 2 epsilon-4 alleles performed significantly worse in all domains. An editorial by Gary Peavy relates these findings to previous research. Another study showed a similar interaction, but those findings fell short of statistical significance. A third study did not show any effect of ApoE genotype. Methodological differences among these studies could be important, especially as variation in cortisol secretion is common. The mechanism by which APOE status could affect the association between stress and cognition is poorly understood. On the basis of a series of animal studies, a group of investigators postulated that the effects of APOE alter the susceptibility to environmental factors such as stress, or that the threshold at which stress results in damage to neurons differs according to which APOE isoforms are present. Research on the mechanisms by which chronic stress influences pathological aging and cognitive decline is important for determining interventions, either pharmacological or behavioral. Relationships between chronic stress and cognitive changes may be particularly important in the study of Alzheimer's disease. Recent animal studies have shown associations between chronic stress and neuropathological changes associated with Alzheimer's disease, including synapse loss, increases in amyloid beta peptide, and tau accumulation and phosphorylation. Clearly, there are many factors that lead to the pathology and symptoms of Alzheimer's disease, including environmental and genetic factors. Investigating interaction effects may help target the individuals who are most vulnerable to the effects of chronic stress by virtue of risk factors that, when combined, are more harmful than the expected additive effect of each factor alone. Our understanding of the relationship between HPA axis responses to stress and cognitive decline in older adults isn't clear enough to advise screening for lone biomarkers, such as cortisol. However, a reasonable direction would be to assess measures associated with cognitive decline in individuals with known risk factors for dementia, such as age and APOE epsilon 4 status. The development of measures to assess individual differences in reactivity to stress could also prove useful. It is likely that interventions targeting the effects of chronic stress would work best in older adults before symptoms of Alzheimer's disease pathology are detectable. Interventions, particularly behavioral ones, could provide an affordable way to change or reduce harmful responses to stress. There is evidence that brain damage from stress is reversible. However, there may be a point after which the regeneration of neurons or their synaptic connections in response to waning stress is no longer a possibility. Thus, it's critically important to have longitudinal studies that employ valid, reliable measures of chronic stress and are designed to trace pathways from the experience of stress to cognitive decline. This concludes the audio highlights of the November issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. We invite you to our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the full text of these and other articles. We also welcome comments regarding this audio. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psych.org. Thank you.